Jema. So we enter the second chapter of part 2 of second series of essays on the Gita, and the chapter is above the gunas. So gunas, as we know, is the qualitative mode of nature, which is a very different way of looking at things than the way we look at nature today. So we look at the quantitative aspects of nature. So we look at everything is to be measured. And based on measurement, we talk about nature. But there is a qualitative aspect of nature which is so important, and we completely miss in our modern scientific discourse. To put it in very simple practical terms, what it means is, well, there is a little story about three persons building a city. Okay, let me put it on our will. So three persons out of many involved in building a city, let's say taking their work was the same. They are picking up stones and taking it to some place to put on, you know, a wall which is being constructed. So when some passerby asked one person, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, don't you see? Are you blind? What a mechanical work I am doing day in and day night. But I have to do it because that's where destiny has led me. And I have no choice now." So this is one person's reply. So the man asks another person who is also doing the same work. And he asks him, "What are you doing?" He says, "I am earning my livelihood and I am looking for better prospects." And the third person was asked, "What you are doing?" He says, "I am building the city of the future." See, all three are doing the same thing. So, does it make a difference to the work that is being done? And we can apply it anywhere in life. The man, let's say, is a doctor, my profession. You are seeing a person simply because it's now a routine, a habit. You have got used to check the temperature, pulse, blood pressure, and, you know, give medicine. Or I am doing it because I have to earn money, build a hospital, maybe send my children abroad, or I am doing it as a seva, as a genuine service to humanity or God, whatever way we look at it. So, is there a difference in the quality of the work or not? And we can take several examples. Take the example of, at a most material level also it applies. The train is running, is a fact. And you can measure the speed at which it is going. But what is the fuel? What is the kind of energy that is inside it? That makes a difference to the possibilities of the train, to the pollution in the environment, and so on and so forth. So basically, behind the quantitative aspect of creation, there is the qualitative aspects. And this was given great importance in Indian thought. Because it is the quality which actually determines the, if you may use the word, actual quality of the work. You may do the same work. One may do the same work morning to evening, running up and down, apparently because one wants to serve the divine outwardly. But one may be simply doing it for flattering one's own ego or somebody else's ego. And one may be doing a little work but doing it with all awareness and concentration as a dedicated service to the divine. So we can take any number of examples. So when we talk about nature and the gunas and swabhava, guna by means, it means quality, and guna swabhava means everything has its own unique kind of energy, quality of energy, which determines its swabhava. For example, if a man with a kshatriya swabhava is trying to study something, so he'll like to break through into new fields. He's a kshatriya by nature. And he, you know, if a vaishya temperament or swabhava is studying, you will see how this knowledge can be effective and useful for making, you know, products and marketing. And if a Brahmin is doing it, he would want to go beyond the fixed paradigms into new fields entirely, because he wants to go to the ultimate knowledge. So swabhava, so guna and swabhava, they determine the actual quality. And the Gita goes on to describe, it will come in later chapter, that the value of your action does not depend on the action itself as much on the mode in which you are doing, and the result will be according to that. That's something very interesting. A lot of people say that I did this, what did I get? So if you do an action now we know the three gunas are tamas, rajas and sattva. Tamas is the principle of inertia and they are universal, though Gita at this point speaks only in terms of the human beings. To make it easier, it's like Shri Krishna is zooming in. But it applies everywhere in nature, it applies to food, it applies to every object in creation. So tamas is things which are done, it's the mode of inertia. So what happens when there is a mode of inertia? It opens, it just bears all the shocks of the world without making the chesta or the effort to master it. So what happens? Eventually there is the disintegration which sets in. If you just blindly just bear the shocks of the world, you cry, you weep, you say life has been very bad with me, God has been unkind, world has been unkind, it doesn't help. You will keep going down towards the spiral because it's a tamasic mode. Tamasic mode simply bears. That's it. Its power is to bear and endure. But then what happens? The attacks keep mounting, which they would. So it's the principle of disintegration. Tamas leads to disintegration. So people who just lie down and they are in a mode of inertia, they tend to fall sick very often. Even it's known that even your bones start undergoing degeneration, osteoporosis and all that. So this is one principle. Then there is that, as if to counter it, there is the principle of kinesis. So in every atom we'll see this, these three forces. Kinesis is rajas. Rajas takes upon the challenge of life and wants to master it. So it is driven by passion, it's driven by desire, it's driven by ambition, and therefore it moves into the world to wrestle, and even if defeated, it attempts to conquer, to succeed. So this is the rajasic mode. But then there is a third principle, because a man, if he is driven only by the rajasic mode, then it will be like a recklessly driven motor car. So this is the principle which says, hold on, go slow, take it easy. You have to take into mind that there are other people in the traffic also. So when you do that, then there is a principle of equilibrium, which takes into account all that is happening around, wants to balance out. So you have these three principles of nature, three qualities. One is tamas, which is about disintegration. Rajas, which is about action and creation. And the third is sattva. Sattva gun is about balance and equilibrium. So all these three are active everywhere. And it's very interesting that all the three devas, the three, the great ones, the ultimate three dev. So they are also, you know, like Shiva is tamoguni. So he destroys, he is the one who is the great destroyer. He disintegrates whatever has gone into inertia. So of course he is doing a good thing, because whatever has gone into inertia, refusing to progress, that he destroys. So that's why his place is Samshana Bhumi. Then there is Brahma. Brahma is Rajoguni. It's very interesting, because he's all the time creating. Now if you keep creating, and you know, if it's like too many goods are coming into this Savitri Bhavan, somebody has to organize, arrange it, put it into order. Otherwise there will be chaos. So Vishnu is Sattvagun Pradhan. So he is the one who ordains, arranges things according to a deeper law of truth. So, you know, that's how we have in Indian thought about the three gunas. But this is fine. Now, what Shri Krishna is asking Arjuna is that, see, if you act under the gunas, you will not be free. So we are also, when we are driven by inertia, you know, people often say, man nahi kar raha hai, I don't feel like. So, what is it? It's now mechanic, or it's like, okay, I have to do this work as a drudgery. So what happens? What does it do? If you act under tamogun, or you allow tamogun to take over yourself, what does it tamogun do? Because it disintegration, it only makes the mind more and more clouded and confused, because you are completely succumbing to tamogun. Now the other is people who want to act and overact and hyperact. So that's the rajogun. So when rajogun acts, it brings pleasure and pain, because you are acting under desire to get something. And when you get that object, you will be happy. So you want to gain objects. And after one object, you go to another, third one.
So it is also binding you, because if Rajogun comes, you will be driven to act. So it's a bondage. If Tamogun comes, you are driven to rest. Even if there is work, you prefer rest. So it's a bondage. Now what about Satgun? Satgun is also a bondage, even though it leads towards happiness and light. So Satgun leads towards Sukham and Prakasham. So if you act under Satgun, when you try to create a balance and equilibrium, it is the highest of the gunas. It leads to a kind of very happy state. You know, you are free from many diseases. So the three are described in terms of vehicle motion as the Tamoguni is like the bullock cart. It's going slowly, you start liking it. You know, Tamoguni people don't want to change. They love their village, old time. So the bullock cart going slowly, trinklet. Rajogun is the fast track motor car. And Satgun is the rails. Train is running on rails from one station to another. And of course, the spiritual life is beyond. So it's the airplane and the satellite. So that's the difference. So if you see ever these things in dreams, it indicates that. So now the problem is that, well, how is Satgun a bondage? Its life is happy. It's clear. You are free from many diseases. It's a bondage for two reasons. One is you are bound to a limited idea of right. That's how Satgun operates. This is the right thing to do because it will create balance. So many times people say, I adjust so that everybody is happy. Isn't it? It's a Satgun mentality will do that. That's what Arjun is saying. Let me adjust. I'll go to the forest. I'll take sannyas. Let them enjoy the kingdom. It's a typical Satgun. So when you do that, it opens. The next step is, because they are still under the play of gunas, the second problem is that after a while, Tamogun will take over. So people who are bound by Satgun, bound, they also get prone to then going towards inertia, because, well, Satgun by nature seeks, things like sacrificing yourself for the sake of others so that there can be harmony, there can be equilibrium. So they are also bound. And they have a limited idea of right. This was Arjun's problem, that, well, I should not fight my own kin. So these three gunas are regarded as bondage, cause of bondage. So why it becomes a cause of bondage? Because the soul identifies with them. It's like you live in a place or you are traveling in a train and you get everything that is happening, people around, you make friends and they become, you know, when they come out, you feel sorry, old time trains. So similarly, when you live in a certain environment, you are so identified with that you stop even thinking that the world is much larger movement than this little thing in which we are living. So the soul gets identified with a certain guna, a certain type of movement, and therefore it is unable to shake off the chains and go into the beyond. That was the question that Mirabai asked, that we have talked about it, that, well, what do I do? Should I go by what my demands of my family is? Because she is sattvic by nature. So should I go by all that, or should I follow my highest impulse? And then, of course, she gets the message from Tulsidas that you must follow your highest truth, your highest nature. So she actually goes away, or she's sent away, whatever it is. She doesn't plead. She takes it and goes away. So this is the bondage. So bondage is when you are not having a freedom of action of the soul in its own native right. So if this is bondage, then the next step is that freedom from the bondage. So freedom from the bondage, we know, we have so many Ashtavakra Gita and many others where it's told that freedom from the bondage comes by disengaging from nature, by becoming a witness. You have to realize you are just a drishta and all this is going on. All right, you get the freedom. But then the problem is there. It's not changing. Things are what they are, but you are inwardly arrived at some kind of a freedom. But the Gita takes us to next step, and that's where the beauty lies. So the Gita speaks of sadharma gati. So this nature, which is where I was referring to, Shrivindu, is the answer. So there are questions which have not been raised, but modern mind will raise them. For example, the modern mind will raise, then what is this nature that we call as Maya? So it's mentioned in the scriptures, but never brought to highlight. So this lower nature is, again, just as the soul is a portion of the eternal, this lower nature is a portion of the, is a limitation of the higher supernature. Higher supernature acts in freedom and infinity, whereas lower nature acts in a state of self-limitation. It's a self-limitation. And we can take an example of supposing a man who has done PhD in higher mathematics has to teach a class of, he just comes to his alumni school and he has to address the children who are in standard 2. So he's not going to tell them about all the abstract equations. He will tell them about, you know, very simple mathematical things. So what has he done? He has limited himself. But is he limited? No, he is not limited. Whereas the children who are still in the class, they are limited. They cannot arrive there. They have to go through stages. So there are two kinds of action possible in the world. One is in a state of bondage, when we go through the consequences. Tamogun brings state of cloudedness and delusion. Rajogun brings pleasure and pain. Satogun brings happiness and light. But there is another kind of action, which is an action as the divine acts freely in the world. Like Sri Krishna says, he says, I have no desire for anything. There is nothing which is not accessible to me in this world or any other. Yet, I am engaged in action because if I were not to act, the world would go towards downward. And this applies to everybody, by the way, because each of us is a little, chain in that whole thing. So if we take to inaction, which is where the problem lies, that, well, a person who realizes the self, should he act or not? And if he acts, how does he act? So the answer is he acts as the divine acts in the world, in infinite freedom and delight, which nothing soils, because he has now that light, he has the delight. So even if he's engaged in an extreme rajasic activity like war or politics, he remains untouched. He's not afflicted by desire, passion, or pleasure and pain, because now he is directly acting as the divine acts in the world. So, or if he has to, say, sit quietly, he is not afflicted by tamas, because he is free from that, if such be the need. Or if he is acting in apparently doing the things which are just to maintain a social order, he is not bound by them. So he is not labeling people that, oh, you are not acting according to a social right or wrong, therefore you are a bad person. Because he is free, infinitely free. So his vision and action in the world are very different from a man who is bound. This is the essence of the chapter. But first, Sri Krishna, Sri Aurobindo, takes up the issue of immortality, because we keep talking about it. Even in Sri Aurobindo circles, everybody talks about immortality. So what is immortality? Immortality is not physical immortality, is the last thing. 3,000 year project. It will come one day. But first immortality is to realize the immortality of the soul within. And if it doesn't realize itself, all the rest is later. So that's why the mother says, the day you become one with your psychic being, you discover that you are not bound by death. So you are free from all fear of death, because you discover the immortal self. So this is the immortality. Now, is the soul not immortal? Is it mortal when it doesn't realize it? No, the soul is always immortal. It's just that bound by the gunas, it doesn't know it. It's like when you're watching a movie and you see a cinema a scene which is touches something in the heart, because it reminds you of something, you're crying. There's no cause for sorrow. So what is the difference? It's nothing is happening. You're not afflicted actually, but you have chosen to be bound by whatever is happening on the cinema screen. Therefore, you are crying. But you can equally walk out of the cinema screen. That's what people do, and they should do when they watch a horror movie by any chance. You're free of all fear. So it's a state. Soul is always immortal. But until it has discovered its immortality, it goes into the cycle of pleasure and pain. So we used to do this as youngsters when you're watching a movie, which is, as I said, a horror movie. And if you see somebody is feeling very frightened, arey yaar, this is movie hai. Itna sochne ka nahi, you know, you just remind him, as if, oh, for a moment he is fine. Then he's back into the movie. So, because these are two states. One is when you are not aware of your immortality and you are bound. Therefore, you are bound by the cycle. You will drag on into the movie. You don't realize you can get up any time. That's what Ashtavakra says in the Ashtavakra Gita. None is bound, none is free. Shobhinda says the same thing. None seeking to be free. It's a choice that it has made. Otherwise, soul is not bound that way that it's bound by some compulsion. But it has chosen to enter into nature. That's a different thing, which Shri Krishna doesn't address that, why it came. But it is a state. So first he describes immortality. Page 421. To be immortal was never held in the ancient spiritual teaching to consist merely in a personal survival of the death of the body. Why? Because all beings are immortal in that sense. If you go to the ancient doctrine, all beings are immortal. So what is it about? And this applies at individual level, it applies at the cosmic level, what is called as pralaya. These souls that do not arrive at liberation live through the returning aeons, all exist in world or secret in the Brahman. During the dissolution of the manifest worlds and are born again in the appearance of a new cycle. So, the soul is never destroyed. Even pralaya doesn't destroy it. So, one goes back and returns back in the new cycle. So, page 422. To be immortal in the deeper sense is something different from this survival of death and this constant recurrence. Immortality is that supreme status in which the spirit knows itself to be superior to death and birth, not conditioned by the nature of its manifestation, infinite, imperishable, immutably eternal, immortal, because never being born, it never dies. So this is a very famous, wonderful line, little phrase by Sri Aurobindo. Whether I live or die, I am. So it's like just states through which you pass. It's like one of the examples is whether you are a child, whether you are young or whether you are old. You know, faculties, you are there, you have existed. So the same state extend beyond death and after. So there is something, and that's why the drashta bhava is advised. Because if you learn to do that, you will, one of the ways, but it's a more complicated way. Mother has given a much simpler way of finding the psychic being, much simpler. Problem with drashta bhava, it can lead to a kind of egoism of the spiritual witness. There is something like that, and one gets locked into that. So the best way is to discover the psychic being. So when one discovers it, one knows that one has always been and always will be. One knows it not intellectually, but by direct experience. And therefore, one recovers his immortality. Few lines below, the last four lines, it again, Sri Krishna again describes it. Liberation, immortality is to live in this unchangeably conscious eternal being of the Purushottama. So we can use our own yogic yoga term in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. To live in the mother is immortality. And Sri Krishna points toward that. He doesn't say dissolution. See, now the idea of is that you dissolve yourself forever in lay. But he doesn't use that word. He says by living in me, madbhava. Madagata. So that's what he's saying, that by surrender, when you live within the divine being, then you are automatically free, you are liberated. So liberation as cessation of birth and death cycle, or liberation as not being bound to the cycle of birth and death, being conscious and always dwelling in the Lord, that is the difference. Because in one, you are cutting the knot of creation and its evolutionary course. In the other, you are consciously participating in it. And that makes a big difference to, as I keep saying, that India has to get back to the Sanatana Dharma of Sri Krishna. Not this idea of cessation from life and death, like weak creatures. Oh my God, this is so painful, let me escape. Besides, you cannot escape that way. That Sri Aurobindo mentions very beautifully in Savitri, and Sri Krishna also says, the only way you can get liberated is by dwelling in the divine. It doesn't come without that. So very clearly, you have to first arrive at that state. or dwelling in the Brahman, if one likes to, doesn't, you know, like that word. It must put on the law of the divine's supreme way of existence, which is in fact the real law of its own eternal essence. In the spiritual evolution of its becoming, no less than in its secret original being, it must grow into the likeness of the divine. So we can say everywhere that when a common citizen goes, he has to follow the law. But there are people who the law is bent for them. Now we may not like it, but the fact is he has reached that point and he has earned it. In the ashram context, I take this, people are asked to open the chappals outside, no? But many of us walk inside with the chappals. So what happens if somebody asks that why this inequality? I say, because I am part of the ashram. So you see the difference. You also become, you will enjoy this privilege of opening the chappals inside if that's so important to you. So the point is that, well, if you live in the divine consciousness, by its very nature it changes things. There are things which don't apply to the divine. When Sri Krishna engages in, you know, Yudha or Rama, they are not incurring sin. That's what you have to understand. He is acting in his infinite freedom and infinite wisdom. But when we do it, not that sin is, of course, a dated concept, but we are getting bound. That's the impact of such activities, because it's being done for very selfish reasons. Whereas when we do the same action because we are impelled by the divine or even by Satguna, the impact is very different. So this is the difference between Karna and Arjun to start with. So people say often they were equal warriors. I said far from it. Karna is impelled by extreme Rajogun. Arjun is at least sattvic to start with. And later on he is acting under Sri Krishna's command. So even if they were, they are not, but even if they were equal in terms of their merit or capacity, still the guna will make a big difference. So this is the thing, we have to become one with the divine nature. So there is a divine nature, Sri Krishna speaks of that in the Gita. And there is a lower human nature which is bound by the gunas, and the divine nature is free from the gunas. Now what that super nature is, he is not describing it here. And we can leave it for some other time. But there is a divine nature. When Krishna acts, he acts with a very different locus standi. And that's why we cannot understand divine action. That's why we see in Ramayana when Bali questions Rama, "Main bairi Sugriv Piyara, kahu nath mam kahe mara?" Why have you killed me? You are supposed to be equal minded. Why you are friends with Sugriv? And why you are killing me? I have done no harm to you. And then beautifully Ramcharitmanas explains what is the locus standi of Rama. That locus standi is very different than, you know, he is not engaging in a personal feud between Sugriv and Vali. His task is to establish a greater dharma amidst the animal humanity. So he explains Vali, all his actions, gives him a mirror. So this is where we have to understand that we have to grow from the human into the divine nature, not run away from nature and escape into the jungle. And there is such a thing as divine nature. And this great thing, to rise from the human into the divine nature, again and again, divine is not just a state of Brahman, but also there is a nature. We can only do by an effort of Godward knowledge, will and adoration. So he is giving us a method also, which of course all through Gita we find. For the soul sent forth by the Supreme as his eternal portion, his immortal representative into the workings of universal nature, is yet obliged by the character of those workings. So who are we? We have been sent, come from the divine to work here. This is a workplace. If we don't understand how to work, we have to ask the divine how to operate. That's called God knowledge, God-driven action. And when do we have a hotline? So there are three methods, he says, God knowledge, so that when we act, we don't act under the gunas, but under a greater light. The real reason, by that knowledge, by that will, why things are the way they are. And another way is by God-driven action. So when we act on behalf of the divine, as a servant of the divine, as a tool of the divine, we automatically grow into the divine nature by the very fact that we are lending our body and mind to the service of the divine. And when we act in love with the divine, that is the highest.
So there we automatically grow into the likeness of the one whom we love. So these are the three ways to grow into the, through God knowledge, through God work, and we see this toward the end. So first is God knowledge. Perfection cannot come on page 423, somewhere in the middle. Perfection cannot come without self-knowledge and God knowledge and a spiritual attitude towards a natural existence. And that is why the ancient wisdom laid so much stress on salvation by knowledge. Not an intellectual cognizance of things, but a growing of man, the mental being, into a greater spiritual consciousness. What it means is, I must understand and see in the light of the divine why he does what he does. So if I understand the divine intent, I'll be able to act in that light. It's not about intellectually understanding it, but by living in that light. So growing into the spiritual consciousness. Then the second is, few lines below, divine works are effective for salvation. So one is divine knowledge. Divine works are effective for salvation because they lead us towards this perfection and to a knowledge of self and nature and God by growing unity with the inner master of our existence. So when you are working for the divine, automatically the divine is constantly rectifying, helping you to slowly shape the instrument into the divine way of working. There are so many beautiful instances of people here. Like Chandradeep had developed the capacity. He was given one of the work of distributing letters. So he, when the letters would come, he would not read the names. He would just keep this for him, this for him. So he develops those capacities and faculties which are needed for action, simply because we are engaging in divine service. And divine love is effective because by it we grow into the likeness of the soul, soul and supreme object of our adoration, and call down the answering love of the highest to flood us with the light of his knowledge and the uplifting power and purity of his eternal spirit. So these are the three ways by which we can grow into the divine nature, and naturally we grow into the likeness of the one whom we love. So then you don't have to do anything. Just by the force of love, the divine starts pouring his love into us. Then he speaks a little bit about the three gunas, and we can read that. We have spoken about quality and quantity, so I'll just skip that part and come to, on page 426 and 427, he starts speaking about the three gunas. Page 427. The three qualitative modes of nature are inextricably intertwined in all cosmic existence. So they are there. In Indian science develops it to what extent? It goes into food you eat. So there is a food which is more sattvic. So succulent fruits, they are sattvic in nature. Then refrigerated food is tamasic in nature. Very spicy, hot food, meat, it's rajasic in nature. It's not about being good or bad. It's not about you are doing sin or not. If you eat rajasic food, it will stimulate you. And if you, alcohol and drugs are tamasic in nature. So you take that, your consciousness will go toward degeneration. They take away the clarity and the light, the knowledge. There is a simple solution to everything. Come. Don't worry. I can be audible enough. So he says, tamas, the principle of inertia, is a passive and inert nescience, which suffers all shocks and contacts without any effort of mastering response, and by itself would lead to a disintegration of the whole action of the energy and a radical dispersion of substance. So if you, people often say that, well, I have been doing nothing, I have been bearing the shock of the world, you will continue to bear it, because the reason why it is coming is to awaken in you the urge and the will to fight and conquer. The camel man must change into the lion man before he changes into the child man. So this is a stage, and you can't avoid it. You may cry to heavens, you may
do anything. But these challenges of life come to compel us, push us to the wall, so that we make a choice. If you say, no, I am not going to make, God will do something, well, He is doing that. So, He will say, you are making a choice to remain like that. So this is how, you see what happened in India. Everywhere it happens at national life. See, the Mughals came, the Britishers came, and the Mughals came for a long time. We were all, you know, all this is Maya, all this is Maya, till Shivaji and Guru Gobind Singh rose up. If this is Maya, we are children of Bhavani. Now you see, it started giving a pushback. Similarly, when the Britishers came again, oh, they are superior people, we are nobody, we are just meant to do jihajuri. Till Sri Aurobindo and Swami Vivekananda, and then Sri Aurobindo comes and says, what? Lions roar. Now you see, immediately things change. So it is a challenge. You can't blame God. Some people say, what were the gods doing when when Somnath was being captured? So I tell them that what was, were human beings doing when, you know, gods were asking this question? What are you fools doing? You have not embodied a single quality either of Shiva or Krishna. You are simply hugging the idols, doing the Abhishekam, but not a single quality. And therefore you want, you know, there was a recent story of a lady who fought against the Portuguese, and for good number of years, 30 years, she gave, pushed them back, just a small little village. And while they captured Goa, they captured, she was near Mangalore. You see, when you push back, it's meant for that. So this is tamas. And then there is rajas, but it is dominated by a huge force and impulsion of mute rajasic kinesis, which drives it even in and even by its dispersion and disintegration to build and create. Now you see, how does disintegration, rajas drives it to create? So when you look at the Big Bang, there is extreme disintegration from that state. But this disintegrated energy floats and becomes into stars which are whirling in space. That's how the divine works. So it creates even out of that. So rajas is all the time active. And then, so that's why nowadays sometimes in psychology, people say that well, if you feel you are totally disintegrated because life is, then rebuild yourself. That's what rajas wants to do. So don't cry like a helpless victim. And then there is the sattva. So what does each one bring? So it talks about tamas. It talks about page 428. But met on one side by the disintegrative power of tamas, and with death and decay and inertia, its ignorant action is on the other side of its functioning, settled and harmonized and sustained by the power of sattva. So what is the action of sattva? That is very interesting. We read the last five lines on this page. Sattva, it tells us, is by the purity of its quality a cause of light and illumination, and by virtue of that purity it produces no disease or morbidity or suffering in the nature. What a treatment. Imagine if patients come, if I were to prescribe, follow a sattvic life, that's it. Many of the lifestyle is basically a sattvic life, unwittingly. So if you follow a sattvic life, which is in balance, in harmony within, in harmony with nature, in harmony with the rest of the world, and it itself will be, give us a great freedom from disease and morbidity. When into all the doors in the body there comes a flooding of light, as if the doors and windows of a closed house were opened to sunshine, a light of understanding, perception and knowledge. When the intelligence is alert and illumined, the senses quickened. See, it repels even diseases very fast, because something within us becomes very much aware of what's happening around. The senses quicken. The whole mentality is satisfied and full of brightness. So then naturally one doesn't run after desires. And the nervous being calmed and filled with an illumined ease and clarity. Prasada. This is sattva. One should understand that there has been a great increase and uprising of the sattvic guna in the nature. So this gives a state of inner prashad, the sense of inner ease, the sense of inner peace and illumination. That itself gives a great relief from many things. So every illness actually comes to remind us that, hello, get back to sattva. You're either under tamas rajogun, or rather tamo rajogun. Basically tamas, but rajogun intervening. So illness comes to remind us to climb to Raju Sattugun. So this is the sattvic. Rajas, again the Gita tells us, has for its essence attraction of liking and longing. Rajas is a child of the attachment of the soul to the desire of objects. It is born from the nature's thirst for an unpossessed satisfaction. It is therefore full of unrest and fever, and lust and greed and excitement, a thing of seeking impulsions. And all this mounts in us when the middle guna increases. It is the force of desire. Again, nothing to do with right and wrong, good or bad. It's not about sin and virtue. It's very simple. If you act under rajas, you're acting under desire. Desire will put you on overdrive. It will irritate the organs actually. Because even if you are, your body needs rest, desire will push you. Even if your mind needs rest, desire will push you towards all kinds of activity. And so the whole system goes into an excitement, into a kind of turbulence, into a kind of restless state, which is never good for health. So it is bound to, and even with the world around, you will be in always conflict and quarrel, because rajas makes you feel, I must have everything to myself. Everybody may not say like that, but it starts like that. I am the one who is the doer. I must be the center. I must be the, you know, king in my little house. Wherever. So what is the problem? You are coming in conflict with the world around you, and it leads to all kinds of pathologies and unhappiness eventually. There is both pleasure and pain. So when you acquire something, there is pleasure, and with that pleasure there comes a little footnote. Buy one pleasure of life, get five sorrows free. It'll come. First, there will be fear of losing what you have acquired. That is a big problem. Because it's object you are holding. So I often say, when people are very possessive in marriage or relationship, as you know what, you don't believe in your own love. That's why you are so insecure. Isn't it? That's why you are insecure. Somebody will go away, so you must buy external means fold. If you hold by external means, the person has gone away without you realizing it. So what's the point? So you see, this is a problem of rajas, that it doesn't know. It wants to hold outwardly, and it can go to any extreme. But then, well, you can't tell this to a rajasic man. He will say, keep your Gita in home. Let me handle it my way. So he has to go through his own difficulties. Then there is tamas. Tamas finally is born of inertia and ignorance, and its fruit too is inertia and ignorance. It is the darkness of tamas which obscures knowledge and causes all confusion and delusion. Therefore, it is the opposite of sattva, for the essence of sattva is enlightenment, prakash, and the essence of tamas is absence of light, nescience, aprakash. But tamas brings incapacity and negligence of action, as well as the incapacity and negligence of error, inattention and misunderstanding or non-understanding, indolence, langor and sleep belong to this guna. So we see all depression, and eventually some people eventually suffer. My child has gone away from me. I said, no, he didn't go away from you, he ran away from you. You never gave him the freedom to be and discover, so he ran away. What does he do? You are trying to hold him tight, live according to your ideas, your way. You may be right, but he has his own path he has to choose. So this is how these three gunas act. Now comes, so this is the three knots which tie the soul. So we have to get free from this. So how to become free? Before that, page 431, something very quickly. But how does sattva, the power of knowledge and happiness, become a chain? This is a common problem that people raise. That after all, I am doing everything according to the rule book, according to the scripture, according to... still I am suffering. to say that. I am doing everything. Because you are too much bound to the scripture and God is infinite. So this is also there, that I am doing everything right. It so becomes because it is a principle of mental nature, a principle of limited and limiting knowledge and of a happiness which depends upon right following or attainment of this or that object or else on particular states of the mentality, on a light of mind which can be only a more or less clear twilight. We can take the example of the Gita under the spell of kind of sattva, Arjun did not fight the war. So what would have happened? Shri Krishna shows him on a TV screen. What is going to happen? He says, first of all, you are going to suffer because you are acting contrary to your own Swadharma. Then when you see that these fellows who have occupied the kingdom, the subjects are suffering under them. Why? Because Arjun did not fight. He says, then you will understand, you will suffer a lot more and hold yourself responsible for this that is going to happen. Because Sattva will say, no, I must not fight because these are my own people. But it's not about your people or somebody else's people. When you have to fight because it's the true thing to do. It is the right thing to do. It is the beautiful thing to do. So that's how Arjun was bound by the Sattva and it was dangerous. It was limiting. So you have to act under the divine impulsion, not under, you know, any mental idea. So that's the yoga altogether. So why the soul has come into it? Shri Krishna doesn't fully take it up. But he says that by attaching yourself to the gunas, the soul becomes bound. Why it has come? He just passingly hints. Okay. So there is something called as attachment even to the right thing. And that also can become a bondage. This is what we have to understand. The mentally right, not right in the highest sense, not in the sense of satyam, ritam, brahatam, but the mentally right thing to do. So that also becomes a problem. So on page 432, yet attachment even to these pleasurable things, that is prasad, 432, somewhere in the middle or little above the middle, must be entirely abandoned. First, because in the mind they are limited and limiting forms, and secondly, because since sattva is constantly entangled with and besieged by rajas and tamas, which may at any moment overcome it, there is a perpetual insecurity in the tenure. There was this person in the ashram who was working, I believe in the bakery, if I am not mistaken. And the mother wanted some bread. For some reason, I am forgetting the whole thing, but she asked someone, go and get some bread. So when the person went to the bakery and asked for bread, he said, but it is 5 o'clock and the department is closed. So, now this is sattva. Department is closed. Mother has given the order, it should be closed. So, but mother is asking, ask her to give a chit. I am telling a true story. Now this is how the sattvic mind operates. It has a framework and is bound by in that frame. So, mother laughs when she describes this story. So this is called being bound by the mental conceptions and of right and wrong. So what we have to do is we have to abandon this attachment also. So this is but even if one is free from any clinging to the fruit. So first is nishkam karma. One, like we want particular fruit. So even for sattva, we want, for example, people want to be good in everybody's eyes. Now this is how sattva operates. Rajas operates, I want to be somebody special in everybody's eyes. Sattva wants, I want to be good in everybody's eyes. See, I am the most cleanest man. This man has never quarreled. This man has never done this. He has never done this. So you want to be to that extent. And this keeps me fine. Happy and healthy. So this is another kind of desire for the fruit, which may be very subtle, to look good in people's eyes. So that's what Arjun wants in a very subtly, that all my relatives will say, ah, here was a great warrior who abandoned the war for the sake of all his relations and saved a massacre, he'll become good in everybody's eyes. But even if one is free from any clinging to the fruit, there may be an attachment to the work itself. Either for its own sake, the essential rajasic bond, or owing to a lax subjection to the drive of nature, the tamasic, or for the sake of the attracting rightness of the thing done, which is the sattva, attaching cause powerful on the virtuous man or the man of knowledge. I have to do this because this is the work which is given to me. So he becomes attached to the work itself. And even when time has come, it's like there are people who stick to their chair. Even after they have become dated. Why? Because they take it that divine has put me here. Now this is where, you know, the test comes. How rajas intervenes and how ambition has entered into the play. So it may be one work today, you should be ready to do something completely different, or just to do nothing and just sit quietly, if that be the calling. So to give up the action itself to the Lord of works and be only a desireless and equal-minded instrument of his will. This his will should be underlined 100 times. If his will be, act here, act. If his will be, come away, come away. If his will is, sit quietly. And if his will is, that, you know, engage in war, engage in war. So basically, if you take the example of old time Madaris who used to make the monkey dance. So what is the difference? When we dance to the tune of the mind Madari, we become what we are. But when we want dance to the tune of the great Madari, the divine, Rama, we become Hanuman. This is the difference. So we have to learn to dance to the tune of the Lord and not to the tune of the world. Not to please others, not to please oneself. To please oneself is rajas, to please others is sattva. But to please the Lord, that's what the mother says. To give up the action itself to the Lord of works. To see that the modes of nature are the whole agency and cause of our works, and to know and turn to that which is supreme above the gunas is the way to rise above the lower nature. Only so can we attain to the movement and status of the divine madbhava, by which, free from subjection to birth and death and their concomitants, decay, old age and suffering, the liberated soul shall enjoy in the end immortality and all that is eternal. So Arjuna naturally asks that what is the sign of such a person? And Sri Krishna again comes back one word, equanimity. And what is the sign of such a person who has risen above the gunas, tragunyatit? Because outwardly it is, he is doing the same action. He is not stopped action. What is the sign? So Sri Krishna says, sama losht kanchana. First, he regards the mud and the gold. Equally, it doesn't mean it doesn't know the difference between the two. It's not blood. But if he gets gold, if he is in a palace, he doesn't say, no, I'll not go in a palace because I'm a sannyasi. Then you are attached to your sannyas. Equally, if he has to lie down on the floor, he doesn't say, oh my God, this is very uncomfortable. So he is equal-minded. If he gets praise from people, he is not moved by it, oh my God, see? I am someone. And if he gets blame from people, equally he is not moved. Oh my God, I do good. Everybody criticizes me. No. So he is equal minded in all these things. And therefore, to him the pleasant and the unpleasant, praise and blame, honor and insult, the faction of his friends and the faction of his enemies are equal things. He is steadfast in a wise, imperturbable and immutable inner calm and quietude. He initiates no action but leaves all works to be done by the gunas of nature. Such a man will not say, oh, I must do this. He'll wait for the inner truth to push him. And he's pushed by that. So he becomes kutastha. He becomes, he's seated in the akshara instead of the shara. And then he becomes seated in the purushottama. That's the always the closing word, page 433, last 5-6 lines from below. So here comes now the crowning note, always.
He also who loves and strives after me with an undeviating love and adoration passes beyond the three gunas, and he too is prepared for becoming the Brahman. So now he is giving us a shortcut. One is all this exercise, shara, akshara, and all this. Now the other shortcut. Shortcut is loving the divine. That's why Shobhinda says, open to the mother, open to the influence. Give yourself. Mother takes it to another level altogether. This eye of the Purushottama, who is the foundation of the silent Brahman and of immortality, an imperishable spiritual existence and of the eternal Dharma, and of an utter bliss of happiness. There is a status then which is greater than the peace of the Akshara. We may add the word Brahman. As it watches unmoved the strife of the gunas. So there is a status greater than the Drishta, greater than the Brahman, Brahmic sthiti. There is a highest spiritual experience and foundation above the immutability of the Brahman. There is an eternal Dharma greater than the rajasic impulsion to works, pravritti. So there is a divine Dharma here is in the sense of impulsion, unfolding action. So there is something greater than rajas. It's not like we have to act under rajas. There is something, or under sattva, there is something still greater. So Akshara Brahma frees us from this, but it doesn't give us the greater principle of action. That's the problem of the two Purushas and the three Purushas. He'll talk about it in the next chapter. If you only talk about this world and Brahman, then we don't find the foothold for action again into the world. But the moment we say that the Shar and Akshar rest on Purushottama, whose divine nature, supreme nature, has become this lower nature, then we have the key. That's where Sri Krishna, Shobhinda are leading us. There is an absolute delight which is untouched by rajasic suffering and beyond the sattvic happiness. And these things are found and possessed by dwelling in the being and power of the Purushottama. And how to get it, so sweet as always. But since it is secured by bhakti, its status must be that divine delight. So ultimately the sign of such a person is not only full of bhakti, not rajasic bhakti, not sattvic bhakti, not tamasic bhakti. Tamasic bhakti is every day doing the ritual. Rajasic bhakti is God transactional, give me this, give me that. Sattvic bhakti, because it is enjoined in the scripture, therefore I am doing it. But bhakti, which means the bhaj, takes joy in the Lord. So the sign is that you grow in delight. So, in which is experienced the union of utter love and possessing oneness, the crown of bhakti, and to rise into that ananda, into that imperishable oneness, must be the completion of spiritual perfection and the fulfillment of the eternal immortalizing Dharma. Jai Ma.